This is Barry Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. Today is June 9th, the year 2004. I'm in Aaron L. Friedman's office in the University Clinics, and we're going to continue the discussion we began yesterday. Could you talk a little bit of this? I should have asked this when we were talking about your colleagues here in the department. Could you talk about a little bit about the support staff you've worked with during your years at UW?
Yeah, I'd like to mention three people because I think they're in different levels, but they've all been crucial. The first laboratory tech or a support person that was in my lab was a woman named Rita Pitier. And what I remember more than anything else is that this is a small lady, quiet, very effective, who had the capacity to help with experimental design, but even more importantly, had the willingness to say, you know, I'm not sure about that. Mm. and
that's
we
good.
Had these.
Why is that important?
I had these very interesting conversations. It actually taught me something very, very important. That she had some experience before, so she came mm-hmm. to my lab after having been someplace else. And only later did she explain that she found it interesting that I was willing to actually take her advice. Mm. Because one of the reasons that she felt she had to leave is that she knew she was about to embark on things that weren't going to work.
Mm. Mm.
But they had to be done because the person insisted that they do them and they do them the way he said. So Rita was a huge help to me and a very dedicated individual. Once I became chair of the department, there are two people that I just have to mention. Of course, mm-hmm. Sue Burke is one of them. Sue started working with
me. She's your administrative assistant.
She's my administrative assistant, right. Sue started working with me a little bit after I started in the job because the previous administrative assistant for the chair of the department went to work for Phil.
Right.
Farrell,
yeah, happens,
in
right.
the dean's office. And he and Carla just had and still have a wonderful working relationship.
Carla.
Eakins is her name, yeah. So Carla moves to the dean's office, and now I have to find somebody. Mm-hmm. And along comes, very fortuitously, along comes Sue, first as an LTE, and therefore we had great risk of losing her. But fortunately, we managed to be able to have her stay in a full-time position. And what Sue does is...
So she's been here since...
Since your... 1995,
okay.
Yeah. So we worked together for 9 years. What Sue does for the department is you cannot train people to do this. You cannot get people to be genuinely helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, genuinely.
Yeah.
You can't train them to be considerate 100% of the time on the telephone or in person. And so she is, as I've said to many people, she's the first contact that many people have with the department, and their contact will always start off in a pleasant way.
Well, you know, I had that same experience. Right. My first contact was mm-hmm. Sue, and she made me feel part of the family from the get-go,
right.
And I knew that I could turn to her whenever I needed had a question.
Right. And that has been, I think it's paid dividend upon dividend mm-hmm. over the time that we've been working together. And she's very competent, and she does mm-hmm. lots of other good things. But that quality, you could write that into a job description,
yeah.
You could do all sorts of things. You don't get it,
yeah.
But she hasn't. And it's been wonderful. She's, my analogy is she's sort of radar in the old mesh.
The old mesh. Radar O'Reilly.
And Sue will show up with something, and she'll go, I think you're going to need this.
Hand it to you before right. you ask for it.
And the other person is Marcia Wendt. Marcia Wendt is the administrator for the Department of Pediatrics. So she has an MBA, and she mm-hmm. Is actually crucial to the financial well-being of the department. And she and I have had, I think, a terrific mm-hmm. working relationship. Partly because I learned pretty quickly that Marcia was full of good ideas, and so looking to me to come up with them me trying to figure them out when she had them already. So my questions to Marcia were always, after we would pose an issue, was, what do you think we ought to do? and very often we were part of the way there after she finished speaking. So. Those two people have made being chair, for me at least, much, much easier and far, far more pleasurable than it could have been under other circumstances.
Now, she has a legendary name, Wendt. Is she by any chance related, do you know, to Kurt Wendt, who was dean of the College of Engineering for, 50 years, but a long, long time.
I don't know the answer to that, she's never mentioned it. And she did grow up in Wisconsin, but actually I think she's from Waukesha.
I talked yesterday about a summation question of the Department of Pediatrics, but it wasn't quite appropriate to ask it at that point. We've just talked about the department, or we finished talking about it yesterday. Look at the pediatrics department in 1981, when you first arrived on the faculty. You were here, of course, a little bit before that as well. And today, in 2004, as you prepare to leave on the next leg of your career journey, what are the biggest changes that you've witnessed over time in the department?
Well, first of all, it's considerably larger, and that is both good and bad. And what I think has happened with this increase in size is it's more complex.
Mm-hmm.
We are a department from a clinical standpoint that's able to provide for our patients to a much greater extent today than we were able to do 23 years ago. But at the same time, we're a department that's more far-flung.
Hmm.
We know each other less well. And the sense that you're in it together, the 23 or 25 or 30 members of the department back then and the 80-some members now are not in the same, you could go for an extended period of time and not meet more or not run into the majority of the people in the department. So that has, it's brought with it, that enlargement has brought with it, I think, a diffusion of the sense of togetherness that was exciting, and it was interesting going back a quarter century. It's also, I think, inevitable in the way medicine has worked and in the way that academics has developed, that idea that somehow we could stay at that size.
Right, right.
It's simply not possible anymore. But we did lose something when it happened. I think that's the single biggest change. There are all sorts of other things. The role of the clinical programs in academic medical school departments is very different today than it was 25 years ago. It has a much more important role. It's financially more necessary. It is a bigger piece of what we do. We are required to spend more time in our clinical work simply by virtue of what we have to fill out and respond to. But in truth, that's happened to everybody else. That is, it's happened to every physician around the country who's doing just clinical work, for example. But that loss of that spree, that loss of that camaraderie, I think, has been the biggest downside to what inevitably was a better provision of care for patients.
And it's building, or not building on, but it's relating to what you said yesterday, where you were in the old hospital, you sort of had this feeling of camaraderie with more or less the entire hospital staff, and then you came out here, and now, it's the same thing. It's that growth which is inevitable, which has its drawbacks.
Now, the upside to that last point will be, I think the new Children's Hospital, when it's completed, will help bring some of that back.
Yeah.
We will be spending more time together. Especially for the staff, it will help bring some of that.
Boy, that sure will. Children's Hospital.
Right. Patients, staff will know precisely where they are. They are in the Children's Hospital. Yeah. They're not making their way to it.
Yeah.
And finally, they're going to be in it. And they'll be in it from the time they leave the outside and walk in the front door to the time they get back outside.
When is the schedule?
It's groundbreaking. It's supposed to be, I think, in October of this year. And my guess is that it'll really be finished in the spring of 2007. Yeah.
That will be something you'll miss.
You'll
certainly come here for
that. I will be back for that. It's too exciting, and it was so much a part of what I was interested in doing for the last 10 years that it's. I'll be back for it for sure.
Let's look now at the three-legged stool: teaching, research, and service. We've talked a little bit about teaching up to this point, but I'd like you to talk more about your teaching. And I guess in the medical school that would include also your clinical work. They're kind of one and the same. Perhaps you could start out by talking about your initial experience, in these two areas, and then kind of bring it up to the future from there, or to the present.
All of us are are products of what I like to call apprentice training, which is to say, even from the beginning of medical school, and then as you train as an intern and a resident, there's an explicit understanding that part of the way that you're going to learn is you're going to follow an example. You're going to follow somebody around. You're going to watch how they do something, from taking a history to performing parts of a physical exam to the use of certain technology, simple technology like a stethoscope or more complicated technology like an X-ray machine. And you're going to learn about diagnostic tools, not just those, but also laboratory and so forth. And you're going to learn all that stuff at the hand of somebody else. And most of those somebody else's are clinicians. So that form of training is embedded in medicine. And of course, you could see how important that would be for surgeons, for example. I mean, how else would you learn how to do that? But even for non-surgeons, it's a crucial part of what you do. It's crucial to have somebody listen to a heart and then ask you to listen and describe what it is that you've heard. It's crucial to have somebody to look in an ear or look into a throat and have somebody else say, did you see X, and did you, and so forth.
It's
so, so that's apprentice, as I see it, that's apprentice training. And you're really doing an apprenticeship from the time that you start medical school, certainly in the third and fourth year, and that is true today. There are some changes, some big ones. The use of the cadaver as a way of learning gross anatomy is going to disappear probably.
It will
be diminished. Disappear may be a little bit harsh, but it will diminish because of virtual realities and the use of the computer and so forth that can give you a three-dimensional look at something and be almost lifelike. I can tell you when you look at some of these things and you go, you know, I'm looking at in an artery and I'm seeing it three-dimensional. It's really quite remarkable. So some of that will change as a result of the other things that we can do. But I don't think that apprenticeship training will change very much. And that's still true. And I do that today, and I don't do it a whole lot differently than I did it 20 or 25 years ago. What has changed, and this is an interesting issue, you know, I don't think you can use the Socratic method of teaching unless you have enough knowledge to be able to ask questions and draw out the more fundamental parts of it. And I think that the Socratic method of teaching in medicine is losing out to the to time and to time management. It is longer. It takes more time to engage in that kind of a conversation. And I think it's going to be harder and harder to do. Secondly,
is that bad?
I think it's bad. I think it's bad because the hardest thing to assess for a clinician, for example, is not whether you can create a list or not whether you can choose the most likely possibility, but whether you can take a problem from the way it starts to the way it unfolds and be able to not only throw out or not only find the most important issues, but to throw out all the extraneous information. So how do you know what's extraneous? And you have to work your way through it. It's a series of steps. And the really good clinicians are very good at that, and they do it quite quickly. It's very hard to assess that in a written exam. It's very hard to do that in very short order. It requires the kind of conversation that says, well, you chose this, but there are five other possibilities. Why didn't you go to those other five possibilities? And lo and behold, when you do that, you find out some of the time they were just lucky. They just happened to light on the one that they knew best or whatever, but they didn't really have the depth of knowledge to give you the reasons for why they actually threw the other ones out.
I could see the value of it.
So that's a change. And I think that as we do more and more independent learning, which is one of the things that the new technologies allow, they allow for a degree of independent learning that wasn't as easy to do before. if I am looking for if I want to find out something about a drug interaction, or I want to learn something about a food and drug interaction, or I want to get a more complete understanding of how something might work, how a technology might work, just go to the computer.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't have that conversation with somebody else. So that's the sort of upside downside of what's happening today. So that apprenticeship teaching, I think, is ongoing, and whether we can keep the core of it, that sort of, that kind of opportunity to really have that discussion with a, with an experienced clinician to really help you deepen your understanding, that's going to be hard.
That, I can see how that could be.
That's going to be hard.
Difficult.
The other thing that that we used to do and still do is the classroom teaching.
Mm-hmm.
That is classic lectures. Mm-hmm. There's a move in medicine, as there are in other places, to do what's called problem-based learning, so that you actually set a scenario that might reflect a relatively common clinical scenario, and create a series of questions, and the teaching is around the scenario and those questions,
mm-hmm.
and embedded in that teaching over the course of a half hour or 45 minutes is the lecture that you would have mm-hmm. given on that kind
right.
of condition or that form of treatment or whatever.
Would you use the Socratic method somewhat in that?
I think it's a better, it actually lends itself to the Socratic method.
It sure sounds like it.
And it is a nice way to use the mm-hmm. Socratic method. And again, I think that that is, while there's a lot of lip service to it, it's actually one of the harder ways to teach.
Oh, yes, it is. It sounds a little bit like some friends I know who went through law school, the same kind of thing. You have a case and you go through it and you dissect it.
And I think that's correct. And of course, the risk that you have when you do it with a number of students is that the conversation and the questions sort of get away from you.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to,
right.
and you can tell the really good folks, the really good teachers, because they know how to take the question or where it's going and kind of steer it back on track.
Boy, that's a skill. Yeah.
That's a skill, yeah. But we do that, and so I've given lectures, I've taught it's something that we in the medical school now call Patient Doctor and Society, which is a introduction, used to be called Introduction to Clinical Medicine, but it was a way of teaching people about history taking, about mm-hmm. physical exam, about the professionalism. You know, how do you actually ask somebody about that? What are your sensibilities toward the physical exam if you're a male and you're examining a female and those
mm-hmm.
sorts of
mm-hmm.
things? Those are all things that are not inherent,
mm-hmm.
But really do need to be demonstrated
mm-hmm.
And assessed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all doable. And one of the big, big differences between being a medical student today and being a medical student 25 years ago when I was a medical, or 30 years ago when I was a medical student, is the assessment piece. We do ask people today, we don't assume that they did something. We ask them to show us that they can do it. We don't assume they know how to look in an ear. We actually test for it. We don't assume that they can do a good physical exam, which was true for me, by the way. People just assumed that I did a bunch of them and I know how to do
it. That's interesting.
And all of my examination was primarily written. We were not observed mm-hmm. doing things. We were not asked to do things in a way that could show our skills in history taking, and physical exam, technical skills, blood drawing, and so forth. And we do, we ask people to show us that.
Now, is that in the teaching or in the clinical or in both?
Well, it's primarily in the clinical role. That's where you can actually do it.
But that's where you have that problem, too, with the time management.
Exactly.
You're trying to teach. I mean, something like a physical takes a little bit
right.
of time.
Exactly.
If you've got, I don't know how much time you're generally allowed for that.
But what we do, I think, which is probably not a bad way to do it, is you limit it. And you say, you know, today I'm going to watch you take a history and do a physical mm-hmm. exam on those areas of the chest, for
mm-hmm.
example. And so the questions will be pertinent mm-hmm. to that, and the physical exam will be pertinent mm-hmm. to that. And let's see you do that. Now, as a pediatrician, it's actually interesting because most trainees, especially medical students, don't feel very comfortable working their way around a 2-year-old, for
yes.
example, or a 3-year-old. And it is a bit more of a challenge.
I would suspect so.
But same thing.
Yeah.
You know, the really good, if you learn at the hands of individuals who do an excellent job, you get a bag of tricks
yeah.
that make it possible for you to get quite a bit of information. It really is not veterinary medicine.
And is child management something that you talk about in your class?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And good pediatricians talk a lot about how they approach the child and how they make that initial contact so that they're not immediately viewed as frightening.
Yeah.
And how they engage the child so they can learn things during the engagement. Yeah. The neurologists are particularly good at this. Mm. They have ways of assessing things that they're supposed to assess by the observations and the motions that they ask children to go through, which the child thinks they're playing around with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
So those are all things that you learn, and it is our responsibility to teach people those sorts of that sort of wisdom, which is not generational. Yeah. Like, it expands the generation.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Are there any courses that you've taught pretty regularly over time?
Yeah, I've been involved, because I'm a nephrologist, mm-hmm. I've been involved particularly in what at our medical school has been a second year medical student course called renal pathophysiology.
Is that a required course?
It's a required course.
Since when has that been required?
Oh, way before me.
Okay.
That is, learning about the kidney and how it works, mm-hmm. and what happens when it doesn't work, mm-hmm. has been around since, I think, probably, my guess is the 30s or 40s, when people really started to get an understanding of what the kidney actually did. And so I have taught in that course pretty much since I arrived, and I actually was the director of the course for 8 years.
Mm.
And had the opportunity to do the part that I least enjoyed, to be honest, and that was grading.
Oh. Yes, I could certainly see that. Now, you said when you were talking about getting your specialty that the kidney was something that you just wanted to kind of tackle. It was a challenge and everything. How has that worked out over time? Do you still view it as a challenging thing?
Actually, I have this utmost respect now for how this thing got laid out. and what I mean specifically is I am consistently amazed. I have a line that I use to medical students and residents, which is a good functioning kidney is a lot smarter than you are.
Yeah.
So if you can maintain good function, you got a real friend.
Yeah, that's great.
And so when one learns about how this organ works, mm-hmm. to more than excrete waste products, which is what most people, mm-hmm. think about,
right.
But how it really sort of maintains the milieu of the body, how, mm-hmm. it keeps things in order and prevents, mm-hmm. you from from losing too much water or having too much water, mm-hmm. around, losing too much of these different electrolytes, making sure your bones are okay. There's just a whole variety of things. And I didn't get that when I was a medical student. And I'm pretty confident that medical students don't get it either.
Yeah.
And what I mean specifically is they don't have the kind of in-depth, and they can't. But I've gotten more and more respect for the function of the organ. And I'd like to think that I'm at least able to get people to think about, to appreciate that sort of excitement, even, mm-hmm. if they don't quite understand the intricacies of it.
Also wonder.
Yeah.
That
sense of wonder. That sense of wonder.
Yeah.
And I think this is true for people who do any kind of organ-based work. Mm-hmm. The folks who are studying the brain, I'm sure every day when they're looking at this, they go, there's so many things we don't know, and yet it is so much more capable than what we do know, so there's a lot more there. And I think that's true for us in the community.
Yeah, that's
as well,
great.
So.
I interviewed a very famous botanist at one point. He said every day he'd stop the plants in the window and he'd look at them and he said, what makes them grow?
That's
what he committed his life to. What makes
them grow? Yeah.
You've been doing this clinical work over time. You've been doing teaching over time. Has an approach evolved in you on how you handle the different things? Do you do them pretty much the same now as you did back then?
Can
you talk a little bit about that over time?
That's an interesting question. I would say that with respect to teaching, I have evolved a technique, and partly we have an interesting challenge, which many academics, I think, have. If you're down on campus and you have a set of graduate students and you're also teaching an introductory course, so you're dealing with people at very different levels with respect to what they actually know about the subject, mm-hmm. and also very different levels of what you can expect back from them,
mm-hmm.
In their writing or whatever. And that's true for us.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm teaching in a first and second year medical students, their background is
relatively sparse.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get, you go up to people who are third year pediatric residents, that is, they've spent 3 years in their training in pediatrics, or even beyond that, individuals who've now chosen to actually focus in nephrology. And the real challenge is to not go over the heads of the of the most immature, if you will, of the learners, and not aim too low.
Yeah, talking, right.
But at the same time, try to make sure that everybody is challenged a little bit. You know, that you're asking them for something slightly more than they know.
You're pushing and pulling,
right.
Sort of.
Right. And I think one of the things that's happened for me over 25 years is that I have a much better sense of that now than I had a long time ago. And I think I'm asking the more pertinent questions, the ones that fit the education level of the individuals. That's taken a while to really master.
And that's experience.
That's experience. Yeah. And I remember Dick Hong, who I think I mentioned earlier, is one of the faculty. I remember listening to him give a grand rounds, one of the lectures that has students and residents and general pediatricians from the community and academics in it and so forth. And at the end of it, realizing that he had something in there for everybody.
Oh, yeah, right.
And that is that's an art.
Now, it would be interesting to ask him if he intentionally put something in there for everybody or if it's just something that he's kind of intuited over that.
I never asked that. And I think I can do that better now. And I think I have a sense of what it is that I can expect in return. And periodically you get surprised, you know, somebody's beyond where most of their colleagues are and so forth, and that's very pleasant. Mm-hmm. The light bulb issue that a lot of that academics talk about, you know, the seeing somebody get it is one of those inexplicable moments as a teacher, you know, that idea that you've been involved with somebody who coming in didn't quite get it and now really does get it. And you think, well, great.
Eureka,
that's right. So that part is still one of the paybacks for doing that part of the job.
I couldn't have asked for a better introduction to my next question. I'd like you to talk a little bit about your students. What changes have you observed in medical students, if any, over time? You've been here for a while now. You've had a chance to see them. I'm talking about in terms of work habits, academic readiness, demographics, things like that. And also, if you could just take a couple of your students, whom you've had developed perhaps a special rapport with, and talk a little bit about them and their careers up to this point.
Sure. I think there has been. I don't know that the changes that I've seen at Wisconsin are unique to Wisconsin. In fact, I think they're not. But the computer has made education very, very different today than it was 20 years ago, and certainly 30 years ago. The access to information. It's done one very interesting thing as far as I'm concerned. It's put us in a very interesting challenge. I think the biggest difficulty in being a physician in the 21st century is the explosion of knowledge and the readiness of information, or the availability of information. And how do you do that? How do you balance that as part of your work with your requirement to see the patients, with your requirement to do the other things that you do. And being prepared when you leave a medical school or you leave a training program is easy compared to being prepared 5 or 10 years later. And the reason it's easy is that's been your schedule.
That's it. Yeah, you're up on
that's
it.
Your
yeah.
job. Yeah. You know. But when you have 4 or 5 days of clinical work, how do you learn about what's coming down the pike?
Yeah, right.
And how do you do it in a way that makes it possible to retain it? And in particular, how do you do it in a way that actually changes what you do because it's the right thing to have changed? And I think that's academics, frankly, I think have an opportunity that many of our practicing colleagues don't have because we're in the middle of that all the time. But so that was a bigger challenge, actually, 20 or 30 years ago when you had to find the book or get the manuscript or get the article and so forth. Today, it's at your fingertips. Yes. What that fingertip availability proves is that it wasn't availability that was the problem. The problem was
with the individuals incorporating that mm-hmm. into their mm-hmm. day-to-day activity. And that's really the, I think, the single biggest challenge that we have. Mm-hmm. How do you incorporate lifelong learning into your busy schedule, yeah. your patients, your family, all the other things, your community service that's and so forth? How do you put that in there? And how do you pick out what is meaningful and what isn't in that vast sea of material that's out there to read and look at? And I think our responsibility, part of our responsibility, which is different than it was 20 or 30 years ago, is to help students and trainees learn how to do that.
That's very interesting.
And I believe that we can model it. Mm-hmm. I honestly believe that we can teach people how to be lifelong learners in the same way that we can teach them how to listen to a heart care.
Mm. So you model for you.
You model it. I don't use the same technique that one of my colleagues uses. And I also don't listen to hearts in exactly the same way that. But I believe we can show our students a variety of different methodologies. They have a responsibility to be introspective enough to know what works best for them, from the time of day that it's better for them to do this, to the techniques that they might use to incorporate it, to the way they may file it or bookmark it or whatever. They have to make that personal. But I think we can show them the ways that people maintain lifelong learning. And I think if we have, we've actually completed our task. The front part of it is actually easier to do. It's this part that's the hardest.
So you're trying to teach them an individual learning style,
right.
essentially. Is this something that you're actively you're working on now within
right.
the department?
Yes, we are. And we are actually trying to put that into the residency program, I think.
So you are working on this act?
We are working on that, and we are working on ways to make sure that students are, and residents as trainees, are actually seeing people practice mm-hmm. this lifelong learning themselves. In the old days, I used to just go, I would ask somebody, and they would go to their file cabinet, and they'd say, well, I found this paper, mm-hmm. you know, when I was looking through the journals and so forth. Nobody does that anymore. Yeah. You can't even get the journals anymore.
I think of sitting reading the New England Journal of
right,
Medicine
exactly,
or something in a
exactly.
rocking chair at night,
right,
you know, with the
right.
You know.
And that's still a technique that some people use, but in many instances, you know, libraries are finding the journals too expensive to maintain, and so they're saying, you want a journal, you go online and pay for it and get it yourself. So you've got to incorporate a variety of different techniques. And I don't know that I can teach somebody my technique,
right.
but I can show it to them.
And you can show them that
and you have
a technique and
right.
what it comes from.
And I can show, and they can see somebody else's too. And we have, I think, a responsibility to do that. And there, that I think students, so when you ask me how have students changed, I think students have a responsibility, which in order to be able to accomplish this, you have to have a better understanding mm-hmm. of your own learning
right.
style.
Well, what's more important than that, than learning that, yeah.
And I don't believe that I don't remember as a student thinking about my own, what really is my most efficient way to learn. I don't remember thinking about that.
Heck, I'm just figuring that out right now. No, I think that's very interesting.
But I think that in order to really use this most, in the best possible way, students mm-hmm. are going to have to be more introspective about their own learning styles.
That's a very dynamic approach to learning, mm-hmm. isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it is, and it requires. We're explicit about it. We say to people, you know, you got to ask yourself a few fundamental mm-hmm. questions. So I see people come to Grand Rounds or to one of the lecture type, and they're taking notes and so forth. And so, does that work for you?
Yeah.
Does it really make you learn the material mm-hmm. better, or are you taking notes because everybody else does? But in fact, you'd be better off by closing your book and just looking and listening.
Yeah.
And you can ask people questions like, do you learn from the radio?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some people will have noticed that they do. They actually retain that information. And you can say to them, you know, you might actually consider, put your pen down and just listen to the lecture.
That's interesting.
And that's just one example.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I think that what's really changed over 30 years is that we actually know more about adult education than we did before. We have an opportunity to use it. I think the students have way more availability because of technology than they had before.
Yeah.
And I also think the students, in medicine at least, have changed their focus slightly. When I started in medicine, it was okay to have medicine be a consuming profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over the years, what's changed is there's now a reluctance, or in fact, an even active prevention technique that people use, or not technique, but an active prevention of, or how should I say this? Students actively try to prevent having medicine be an all-consuming
profession. That's really interesting. Yeah.
I believe it's generational. I'm not sure about that, but I think that people are very worried that what happened to Uncle so-and-so, or what happened to a parent, or what happened to a grandparent, or something like that could happen to them. And what they've taken away from it is by allowing the profession to intrude in all parts of their lives, they've led a less fulfilling life. And I have to actively work to prevent that.
I had a rule in college. I never went to parties that were primarily medical students.
That's right.
Because all they want to talk about is medicine.
That's right. That's right.
This is a good thing you're viewing.
I think it's a good thing as long as... Obviously, there's a line there. And at some point, you know, I think that most of us would say we don't want our doctors to be strictly 8-to-5 folks, yeah. And at 5 o'clock they stop doing anything that has anything to do with medicine. When do they learn more? How do they maintain and remain up to date and so forth? It is a profession. It's not a clock-in type of job, and so there is a line. Yeah. There's a line there, and. To the extent that we were over the line for many, many years, maybe even generations, there's an attempt to get to the line, and I think some people go beyond it. They swing beyond it.
The pendulum would be the natural swing. A couple of your students, just talk about a few that...
I have to talk about one now, and one that I knew about 15 years ago.
Sure.
I have a great story to tell about one of our... there's actually a resident, but a trainee that I've been working with for a couple of years who is just, he's magnificent. And one of the things that I find magnificent about him is...
Before you go to the magnificent, a trainee as opposed to a resident?
He's actually a resident. But I use the term trainee as opposed to medical student.
Okay, so this is
somebody who's actually decided to go into pediatrics. And
okay,
is now,
gotcha.
Okay. Now, training is to be a pediatrician.
Okay.
And what's really interesting about... His name is Todd. What's really interesting about Todd is that he has that kind of... genuine interest in what I will call human biology, and especially human biology in the developing human, so in the child, that you just see when he's asking questions, he's fitting things into that understanding of what happens from the time you're born to the time you leave, you complete adolescence. And I think he's going to be a terrific physician because he's going to have that kind of a makeup.
Oh.
And so it's just great to see. And you know, many of the people that we teach and so forth are, you always wonder, why do they choose to come here? And I always feel just lucky more than anything else.
That is an interesting question. Why does one choose one?
That's right, yeah.
So this is not something that's taught. Todd just sort of has this sense of how to,
that's right.
the big picture and exactly how it lays out.
Yeah. He wants to be, I use a term, he wants to be a human biologist.
That's nice. Yeah.
And that's not to say that it's bad to be a practitioner of medicine, but that kind of more fundamental understanding of what goes on with a human being, especially a developing human being, I think he has that kind of drive.
Great.
Many years ago, yeah, it's really a gift. Yeah. And the people he takes care of will be the recipients of that.
Yeah.
Many years ago, now about 15 years ago, while I was working with my mentor, we were both here together, that's Russell Chesney and I were on the faculty together, we had another resident who was not a student here, I believe. I think he did his medical school elsewhere. And I remember him coming to see me once because he was thinking about being a pediatric nephrologist.
Mm-hmm.
But he had abandoned that idea because he had seen how much Russell knew, and he thought, I could never have that kind of, I could never have that that sort of fund of knowledge, let alone the analytical capacity that Russell Chesney had. And I remember having this conversation saying, you know, his name was Scott, and he'd say, Scott, none of us do. So you have to recognize that one of the things that's happened to you is that you've been lucky enough to work with somebody who's really at the tail end of this bell-shaped curve, if in fact there is a bell-shaped curve, and just recognize that most of the rest of us really do fit under the larger part of the curve. And not only are you right, you probably won't be able to have this kind of funded knowledge and be this analytical, but recognize that most of your colleagues will be like you and not like that. And he became a pediatric nephrologist, which I'm proud to say, and is quite good and been quite successful. But it had never occurred to me that somebody might look at us and think that they couldn't do what we do. You know, there may be other reasons that, that are more kind of character or personality-wise, but that somehow the degree to which we understand something would be frightening to
which,
it would be intimidating is never occurred to me. Until that conversation.
That's
so I actually learned a lot from that student.
I would say that you would learn a lot from that. You must learn a lot from your students.
You do.
Too, over time.
You
especially
do.
In a field like medicine. Interesting. Second stool we have is research. When you came into PDET, when you came here, when you were hired in 81, was it?
Yes.
What were, how much was research stressed at that point? And what kind of, where were you in this? What kind of pressure, if that's the right word, did you feel to set up your own research program?
Well, in order to get tenure, I was pretty confident that I would have to have success, which means I would have to have what everybody has used at this campus for a long, long time, an independent-focused research career. Unfortunately, I was able to have that happen.
Now, you said you didn't follow either of your two mentors' research paths.
That's correct.
And I think we talked about a little yesterday, but talk again how how your path developed.
So what happened really is that for me it was a conference, interestingly enough. I was at a, I had been working in Russell's lab and had actually gotten a Russell Chesney's, and I had actually gotten a fair amount of, a fair number of publications out doing the sort of work that he was interested in, which was some fundamental research on how the kidney reclaims things that actually get filtered. So it does some filtering, it does some reclamation. And how that reclaiming occurs was what he was interested in. And he was using a specific marker as the study material to follow. And I'd gotten reasonably good at that, but at a conference, I had gone to a conference in which I was listening to somebody talk about affecting the rate of development or the rate of progression of kidney failure. In other words, if you, what's one of the things that is interesting about the kidney is that many conditions that result in long-term injury to the kidney are sort of one-hit conditions, where something happens in time A, and it doesn't continue to happen, but progressively the kidney gets worse off. And why that would happen in that organ, whereas in other organs you would have to have repeated or progressive ongoing injury of the initial type in order to be able to have loss of function, or in order to be able to create loss of function. Why that? Why the kidney did that was an interesting question, and we've learned a lot more about that. And I got interested in if it's true that inherently the kidney, in effect, sort of wears itself out with time, are there things that we could do, especially in the growing kidney, or in the growing animal, that would delay that progression? And what had come around, what had been batted around for a while in chronic kidney disease in adults and in animal studies that were in adult animals, so to speak, was less protein in the diet. That the requirement to handle protein somehow resulted in injury itself.
Boy, there are a lot of diets out today that wouldn't want to hear that.
That's right. The Atkins folks would not
like this.
But we knew for a long time that people with already injured kidneys, especially significant injury, did better if the amount of protein they took in was reduced. We knew that. That's been known for a long time. But what was thought to be the case was they did better because it was a side product of having too much protein, as opposed to a direct cause of further injury. And that's the direction that I started looking at within the growing animal, where there were very few people examining what happens in the growing animal. And actually, that was an important point, because the growing animals...
Now, by animal, you're talking about...
I use the rat.
A rat. You're talking about an animal.
Right, a real animal.
A real animal.
We learned, and it was probably true for humans, that the kinds of reductions in protein that were being considered for adults were detrimental to children. And this is a very interesting problem in those of us who are interested in pediatrics and in children, in illness in children. And that is, when can you use adult experimentation? And when do you have to look only at the child?
Yeah.
And this comes up more and more. In fact, very recently, the FDA has made it clear that many of the drugs that I've used over the years were never tested in children. They've only been tested in adults, and we've just gone ahead and used them in kids. And,
oh, my goodness.
And that's very common, actually. And most of the time it's worked out. Sometimes it hasn't. But the FDA, fortunately, has begun to recognize and has actually promulgated some rules suggesting that for things that might be commonly used, that drug companies actually perform clinical trials in children.
So this is a rather recent development where there's been
this... 2 years.
Holy smoke.
For most of the medications, most of the antibiotics, high blood pressure medicines, all sorts of things have been used in children because some pediatrician decided to try it in the kid.
Every interview, person I interview, I'm allowed to ask one really stupid question. when you deal with animals, like with rats, is there a difference between dealing with pediatric rats and older rats?
Yeah, there is.
Oh, good.
First of all, they're much smaller, and of course you have everything pushed into a much smaller time frame.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm doing a study, when I was doing studies in the growing rats grow their entire lives. They actually get a little longer no matter until they die.
Mm-hmm.
But when are they no longer adolescents?
Yeah, right.
Right. It's only at about 6 to 8 weeks of life for a rat. So, between the time that they're weaned to the time that they really are through puberty, so to speak, there's about 5 or 6 weeks. So our studies were confined to this very relatively short period of time.
So you were aware of this difference when you were doing your research?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that was known at that time.
Yeah.
Now my research, interestingly enough, got furthered both when I was working for Russell Chesney and when I was doing these protein studies, by an interesting and very important happenstance being at this campus. And that is rat chow, as most commonly used, was actually developed here.
Rat chow?
Rat chow.
You mean what you feed
what the lab rats eat. That's right.
Whoa.
The fundamental diet was actually developed
here. So we do warfarin here?
That's right.
we kill them right here, and
Purina,
we also...
Purina is using a diet that was first worked out here.
Yeah.
And at the time,
that's interesting.
One of the two people who did that work was still here. And I remember talking to him about constructing low-protein diets for growing animals. And the fundamental question there, it was, how do you make sure that the amino acids, the building blocks of protein, how do you make sure that we don't create a different disease by just reducing the protein in the diet?
Yeah,
and
right.
The particular disease is an essential amino acid deficiency.
Mm.
So we had to construct a diet that actually gave them back enough of the essential amino acids so that they didn't develop a second condition as a result of that.
Now, when you're working with rats like that, doing that kind of work, and with computers going along the way they are you able to incorporate computers into that and do simulations and things like that? Or?
Computers would not have been able to simulate these studies.
Okay.
Because we knew so little,
we could not
have predicted the... You couldn't have made enough of a framework to be able to do the predictions. Where they made a huge difference, especially in these sorts of trials, is in the statistical end.
Mm.
And to be able to do much, much more sophisticated statistics this is true for clinical trials in humans, but it's also true in animal trials, so that you can actually use fewer animals, or you can divide the experimental design up differently and so forth. And that's really changed over the last 30 years.
So how far did you get with this particular strain of research, and did it branch out into others, or how did your journey go from there?
Well, we stayed on this for a number of years, and then as the the field grew, mm-hmm. we learned more about some of the things that were that underlie this progression, this mm-hmm. change. And in particular, in our case, we had a negative result. That is, protein restriction was not beneficial to mm-hmm. Young animals. But very, again, fortuitous, around the tail end of my work on this came growth hormone. Mm. And growth hormone was used in humans, but it came from the pineal gland. It actually came from the brains of children and adults who had mm. died. And that was a pretty dangerous mm-hmm. solution to use, yes, given all these other things that give you these illnesses that can come from it. But a couple of the biotech companies actually created human growth hormone mm. In big batches. So it is now much, much more readily available. And one of the things that was discovered by other labs is that some of these growth promoting factors, like growth hormone, could be responsible for some of this injury. Mm. That is, if you force injured kidney keep doing more work, what it, the way it does it is it tries to get bigger. It tries to get every cell to do a little bit more work because the kidney cannot generate new cells. So what's left has to do more. And these growth promoting factors, what they learned is that some of the factors both intrinsic to the kidney and extrinsic, like growth hormone, were upregulated and they caused more growth in the kidney. And that growth also resulted in the development of what's called fibrosis scarring. Mm. If you prevented that growth, you didn't get the scarring. Mm. So we actually started doing studies. We slid a little bit over and asked that question in the rat as to whether growth hormone in the normal or the abnormal rat, that is the animal that has had mm. a renal injury, would in fact be detrimental. Mm. Would the progression be more rapid? Or would it be helpful? Mm-hmm. And so we did a series of experiments looking at the influence of growth hormone given in different ways with different other things. So we had a variety of different techniques. Would that be helpful or not? And we learned that in the rat at least, growth hormone was detrimental. Mm-hmm. And the other thing we learned over time, we didn't learn it, but others have since then, is that those studies in the rat were probably not applicable to humans. Mm-hmm. That in the human, growth hormone is probably not detrimental.
I was going to ask you, do these things then get transferred to humans?
Yeah, our studies did and others is that it really prevented widespread use of growth hormone until mm-hmm. people did the clinical trials.
That's great.
And then once they did the clinical trials, they could more definitively say it's probably not dangerous. Mm-hmm. I think had we not done, not just us, but others, others who had done these things, it probably would have exploded in its use much, much sooner. We would have never really had a chance to prove the point. So that's one of the other ways that
these. That's great. Now you're a very enthusiastic person. I've noticed over the last few days, but I've seen a lot of genuine enthusiasm as you talk about your research, mm-hmm. and you're not doing as much of it now.
That's right.
Do you miss those?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And so the meetings that I go to are. Still pertain to these sorts of things, mm-hmm. and I still get the journals that talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's still fun to read.
Going to be able to return to research at some point? We'll talk about your mm-hmm. upcoming job yeah. soon. I don't think that entails research, or does
actually,
it?
No, it won't. And well. I think the reason that, but I can answer that. It won't take long. I don't believe I'll be able to return to research unless I retool significantly.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That yeah. The, what people yeah. are studying.
What you were talking about before is yeah. Replies to yourself. As
yes,
well.
Absolutely. So I would actually need to have not just a mini, but a pretty significant yeah. sabbatical. And to go back and learn some of the techniques and learn how you can use these in order to be able to go back to doing research.
And that's a comment on how the field is just constantly
exactly.
changing.
Yeah.
Now, just one or two more questions about your research. Early on, how was it funded? And did that change over time?
Yeah, I had both internal grant funding when I first started and external support over the years. And it was broadly based. I had some money from the government, I had some money from industry and so forth to do the studies that I did until I went significantly into an administration, and then I just have to close the lab. But that's part of the responsibility of doing this research. One of the things that I think broadly based, our citizens of the state of Wisconsin don't understand is that the research that goes on, except for the very youngest faculty, the research that goes on at this university is research that's done because the faculty have submitted grants and have been given the opportunity and the support to do them. That grant support doesn't make it possible for me to be a teacher. It does to some degree, but I'm not being paid to be a teacher when the federal government gives me a grant to do these studies. John Wiley has made this point, and I think it is, when the state of Wisconsin looks back and asks the question of, was it worthwhile building a university system or a campus like this, and was it worthwhile having it participate in research to the extent that it did, it would have to recognize that it actually did two things, not just one. It brought together these individuals in the same place, but its initial support was an educational support. What it got as a result of that was a remarkable research engine as well. But it didn't support that research engine with tax dollars. It brought the community together, and the community raised those dollars.
That's always been a tough sell.
It's been a tough sell.
Research.
That's right.
You know, and then you find some, Senator Proxmire with the Golden Fleece Awards, and some research probably is kind of goofy, you know. But
of course.
But
I don't for a minute pretend that everything that people are willing to pay for is stuff that really should be done. But this notion that a university of this breadth and a university of this depth exists because of the tax dollars that are put into it by the state, it's not true. Does a university of this breadth and depth exist solely on the research dollars. But what's happening is the balance that I think was much, much better 25 or 30 years ago is changing. And we are losing, I believe, at risk over time of losing a real gem because we are trying to get it to do something that it isn't able to do without the support that it needs. And that's going to be too bad.
Yeah, that's
going to be too bad.
Wiley's one of his big battles.
It is. It's a big battle. And the state has a... It probably hasn't really engaged in exactly the right conversation to get at the real point. And the real point is that it's not simply that the research engine brings you dollars that are great to have. That's nice. But this community, it requires a community for this to be successful. I am not a better teacher simply because I happen to be a good teacher. I'm a better teacher, and I've learned more because what's around me are people who are doing breathtaking research, people who are excellent teachers, people who provide tremendous service to the community. That's who's around me. And if we lose those, we don't. The place isn't anywhere near as good. It really is greater than the sum of its parts. So that's a long track.
No, that's a perfect way to sum up this. And also, it is really astonishing. I've often commented on this, and people have said the same to me, that a relatively teensy state like Wisconsin could have a university like this sitting here. And as the oral historian, let me tell you, every time I lift up a rock, three or four noted people come scampering out that I've never heard of before.
That's
they're doing interesting work in areas that are
that's
just...
Right. It really is a tribute to the people who were before us. And I guess another way to for this admonition to go is they had the foresight and understood, I think, the value of what they were building. And I just hope that we don't squander that in the long term.
Yeah, that's the challenge.
That's right.
The third leg on the stool, we have teaching, we have research, and we have service. A very strong service component. It's sort of been something that Wisconsin has prided itself in over mm-hmm. time. There's a concept also that's very popular, or that's very important in the history of Wisconsin, and that's faculty governance. Mm-hmm. Talk about faculty governance and the role it's played in the medical school, or the hospital and medical school, I guess, and in the Department of Pediatrics. Yeah.
Well, as you probably know from my CV, I've been the chair of the university committee, so I actually have been sort of in the middle of faculty governance, at least in the last year, and on the committee for the
when
last
were you
3 years, just this past year.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I thought, wow.
I've had a very full.
You've been inundated with faculty governance,
right,
as a matter of fact.
I have to say, I think the faculty governance in many ways is crucial to maintaining a sense of community at Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. When you have a school this size, that is a university of this size, with a variety of different schools that are in it, if there isn't a place for the faculty to think about the school as a whole and to be able to both converse and influence the direction that the school as a whole is going to go, that's a problem. Now, it doesn't start there. It actually starts at a much more elementary or elemental, I guess, mm-hmm. level. That is, inside a department, inside a school like the medical school or the college or inside a college. But fundamentally, faculty are the reason that the university are the reason that the a school of this size, I think it's relatively easy to have a faculty interchange when you're in a school with 2,000 students mm-hmm. or 1,000 students mm-hmm. and a faculty that's relatively small. And I think the biggest challenge we have here is, I'm sure that within the Department of Pediatrics, we feel as if we have a big say in our governance, but with such a large institution, with so many different influences, you want to feel as if you also have some representation in the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think faculty governance is really an important role. It plays an important role. And academic institutions of this kind, when all is said and done, if the faculty is not responsible mm-hmm. for what goes on inside the school, and the most important thing that's supposed to go on inside the school is the teaching of undergraduate and graduate students, if that responsibility is abdicated, if you will, to somebody else, and the rules around which that's going to be done are abdicated to somebody else, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And I think this school has actually worked very hard mm-hmm. to try to maintain that. And the working relationship that exists between the faculty through its governance process and the administration, what I saw was actually, I think, a very healthy working mm-hmm. relationship. It wasn't kowtowing. mm-hmm. It wasn't just whatever you say we're going to do. But it was a real give and take where the administration, John Wiley, the provost, others, are asking for our advice, in many instances for the consent mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. faculty. Mm-hmm. That sends an essential message, and that is that we're in this together, that the administration is here to enable the faculty to do its job. The faculty has a responsibility to do the best job it can, and that combination is crucial to the workings of a large institution.
Now, on the university committee, how often did you meet?
We met every Monday during the school year and three times during the summer.
Yeah. And I know that's an incredible amount of work.
3 to 5 hours every Monday.
Now, what about the involvement of the chancellor? Was he there on, pretty often, or?
Well, the provost was there more often. Right.
Oh, okay.
The provost was there, right, was there more often, and actually, when I started, the chancellor came and the provost periodically, and the chancellor still would come, and he was very gracious with his time. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, when asked, he very often would work things around mm-hmm. so that he'd be able to come. And we asked him because we thought there were things that really needed a conversation mm-hmm. with the chancellor. John Wiley really does get faculty governance.
Yes, he does.
He really yeah. does get it. And he gets it, and what I mean by that is he actually understands it in a way that he will say, I think that's a question that mm-hmm. has to go to the faculty. Mm-hmm.
And that's not because he was skirting an issue, but I think he appreciated that it went to the core and it had to be answered by the faculty.
No.
It's slow. It's meandering at times.
Mm-hmm.
And people will go way off into tangents, as academics mm-hmm. tend to do. But I think that when the key issues come up and you get that kind of debate, and then you get that sort of resolution, it's extremely powerful.
Now, on the committee itself, you have the faculty senate over here, you have the administration with the provost and the chancellor, and you have the committee itself. When issues come in, are they who generally generates them?
Every direction. Occasionally, the chancellor or the provost would bring something because we wouldn't mm-hmm. know mm-hmm. about all these things. Sometimes a faculty senate member, mm-hmm. or just mm-hmm. a member of the faculty, would send us a letter, or send us an email, or ask us a question. And they would go to things like, we would hear things like, I learned from a student that they were asked to do that they had a final exam that was during, that wasn't during the finals week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it seems mundane, but in fact, if you were to take that to its logical extension, that would be a very serious problem.
You bet.
It'd be really tough on the students,
yep.
and it would be unfair. To issues we debated for a long time. How long did you have to be at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, geographically here, to have a degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison?
And you're setting precedent when you do these things.
Well, oh boy,
you better have your arguments now.
Yeah, and you really have to understand, you know, and so what does it mean to have a degree? That's really the mm-hmm. question. What does it mean to have a degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison? And in particular, if you were never here, or almost never here. So those sorts of things, you know, mm. fascinating.
So I want to ask you what types of issues you generally get, but it's really kind of...
all over the board, things like people who've had individual faculty and their tenure clocks, mm. and, you know, we would adjudicate those sorts of questions to really very important issues like, more global mm. issues. Those are important, but more global issues like a degree from mm-hmm. the university.
Right.
Things like due process.
Mm-hmm.
What if we're trying? How do we reprimand or faculty, and what's the right way to do it? So we're all over the map.
Well, it's interesting too, because you do get these questions that seem sort of small and parochial, and then you start undressing them, and whoa, there
that's
it
right.
is.
That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct.
The world is right in front of you.
And I think in many instances they would come to us as seemingly no-brainers, if
yeah.
you will, until somebody who didn't have, as Clinton used to say, a dog in the fight, would realize, but wait a second. There's a much bigger question
yeah.
here.
Doesn't that mean that if such has
right.
us, yeah.
If that's true, what happens then in
yeah.
this case? And that's the kind of thing that, the other, like a lot of other university service in particular, mm-hmm. When you spend time, you said the same mm-hmm. thing, you pick up a rock and some very,
yeah.
when you spend time on a tenure committee or you spend time on a university committee and you see two really wonderful things about the university.
Mm-hmm.
One, there are a lot of smart people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really
these
smart.
Are folks who
yeah.
can really think and I'm not talking about their backgrounds are varied, but their ability to analyze and to dissect and to analyze is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is they're very accomplished people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's quite remarkable to spend time with that and to realize that I've been here a long time, and most of these folks I wouldn't have run into.
Right.
I would have never run into them.
And it's a wonderful experience. It's also a humbling experience.
It's very humbling.
They're just these
very, very humbling.
Great
right.
People out there.
That's right.
Them.
Okay.
I think we'll go down to your departure, which is really coming quickly. Today is the 9th of June, and you're set to leave Madison?
About 10 days.
About 10 days. Holy smokes. Talk about your decision to leave UW and where you're going from here.
Sure. That was, first of all, the decision to leave was really quite painstaking. We've been here a long time, as I've said a couple of times, this has been a great ride.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a terrific opportunity. I've been afforded a great opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I've had, and it could have gone in a lot of different directions, and I think they would have been fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
So my decision to leave really pertained to, I think, an opportunity and my sense of what I thought I wanted to be doing in what I think is probably my last job. Mm. I'm 55, I envision seven to 10 year period of time, but in all honesty, I think that's probably what's, if you will, left is not the right way to say it, but that's how much more is in the tank for me. And so this opportunity really revolved around a larger children's hospital and the opportunity to work in a somewhat different overall pediatric slash children's hospital environment. And I think I was ready for that sort of challenge of taking both of those things on. And looking forward to the opportunity to be influential in that. And so I saw a slightly different and maybe a little bit larger platform there than I think I would have had than I saw here. So that's really the difference.
Different.
It's a different type of university for sure.
You're going to Brown.
That's right. I'll be on the faculty of Brown, and I'll be at the what's called the Hasbro Children's Hospital.
And what would be your position there?
I'll be pediatrician in chief. Is what I have these long titles, but I'll be pediatrician in chief and medical director of Hasbro Children's Hospital,
great.
And chair of the Department of Pediatrics at Brown. Wow.
And when does this start?
Actually, I think it's the July 6th.
Do you have a busy month coming up,
yes,
sir?
Yes, I think so. So we do it certainly, and I know I speak for my wife, we do it with some trepidation.
Yes.
And with some sadness.
Oh, yes.
And having left a community that we loved, and also, for me, a department that I've grown up in.
Many friends.
It's not easy, but I guess I thought, and I think my wife agrees, that this was one of those times when, having been the chair for 10 years here, I had an opportunity I saw a different and probably a larger opportunity there than I think I would have had here. So we'll see.
That's good. That's a tough decision.
It's a tough decision.
Good luck.
Thank you.
I generally end my interviews by asking the person to have sort of a last word. Do you have any closing comments you'd like to make about your career here at the university?
Yeah, I am. I was asked to briefly talk about something in a fair that folks had for my departure, which I was happy to do that. Mm-hmm. And I asked myself, what would I say, other than thanks? And I realized that what is wonderful about a university like this is the opportunity to get into and be involved with what I'll use as a generic term, teams. Mm-hmm. Places where you can take your talents and your interests and team them up with others. And a place of this breadth allows for many, many different ways to do that. In fact, if there's a risk to anybody, especially to a young faculty member, it may be too many choices in the candy store.
Yep.
But that has really been true for me inside the department, inside the medical school, and certainly inside the university. And I think that that is underappreciated by my medical school colleagues, but it is very well appreciated by much of the rest of the university. Mm-hmm. There's just a wealth of opportunity. And it's been, I consider myself very, very lucky. We talked about intersections before. I consider myself very, very lucky that somehow my career evolved in the way that it did. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think I had something to do with that, you know, but I don't think I think in many instances I was making what I thought was the best, what looked like short-term decision, best information I had and so forth. And in many instances, I got way luckier than the decision deserved. So thank you for this opportunity.
I'd like to thank you for allowing me this time in a very busy time in your life.
Well, thanks.
End of interview.